So we're drawing to the close of our retreat. We'll invite Tenajan to give us some final teachings before we finish. We think probably because there's still a mountain of unanswered questions, we'll use that as a framework for the last teaching and carry on as at lunchtime. I can keep asking him the questions, getting some answers. Says sometimes when you ask directly any questions, everyone's dead quiet. But then when you get them to write them down, lots of questions start coming out. Yeah. Sometimes we're shy. We feel a little bit shy. We feel maybe if we ask a question, it'll show like we don't know. So we don't like to let other people that we don't know. The question was, what is the Patimokkha? Because I'm sure many of you saw the monks yesterday chanting the Patimokkha. Literally, Pati means entrance. Mokkha is a way out, so it's the beginning of the way out of suffering. And it's a code or a legal system that the Buddha laid down for monks, you know, the rules of training, rules of discipline. But he didn't begin just laying down a lot of rules. In the beginning there was no formal system, formal legal system or rules of training for monks. They relied on their own good qualities, their wisdom, their morality, and the Buddha would train the monks. But then over time, as the Sangha grew in size, more and more people entered the Sangha. It's natural that occasionally some monks would make mistakes or do things that were inappropriate. And so when such an occasion arose, then the Buddha would lay down a rule saying, well, this way of behavior, this action is incorrect, inappropriate. There's now a rule saying, don't do this, or sometimes there are rules that say you must do something. You can't ignore or not do that, you have to do it. Depends on the rule and the situation. The original perpetrator of whatever the inappropriate action was that led to the rule wasn't actually considered breaking a rule, because the rule didn't exist yet. So they were let off, as it were, or forgiven. But then from then on the rule was established. And those rules gradually came to increase in number to the number of 227. So yesterday when we chanted the Patimokkha, the monk chanted in Pali 227 different rules. And that's what we call the Patimokkha. But actually there are many more rules than that, what we call the rules outside the Patimokkha. Vinaya Pitaka, that part of the Buddhist scriptures, there are actually many, many hundreds of rules, some major, some minor. And there are different classes of rules, some very serious, grave offences that might even lead to a monk having to leave the monkhood if he breaks those rules. Other rules are what we call minor rules, and once having realised he's broken the rule, he reveals that to another monk, lets another monk know in a little ceremony and reveals his rules and misdemeanors, and the other monk gives him an admonition, says, are you clear in what you've done and you're clear that you're not going to do it again? And that's agreed, and then the monk carries on. So that's done every 2 weeks. Monks come together to listen to the Patimokkha and consider their own training and bring up any rules they may have broken. My boss, manager and supervisor are being very nasty to me. How do I face this adversity with a positive attitude? It's normal in the workplace that everybody has different kinds of suffering. Our boss or manager will have their own kind of suffering. if we are under somebody, we'll have the suffering of somebody who's junior or a newer member of that company or workforce. Everyone will have their own particular kind of suffering. It's because we all have to put forth effort to earn a living, to get the basic necessities that we need to live in this world. And that requires effort, physical and mental effort. So it's a requirement for living and working in this world. We have to develop the quality of metta, goodwill. And we develop this towards both the boss, ourselves, to the boss, and to our fellow workers. We have to practice with a lot of patience and endurance towards other people and their characters, their habits, their behavior, and have to try very hard not to give in to anger. So the more we give in to our own anger, this will make it harder to obviously to be happy to settle down. So practice a lot of mindfulness, you know, mindfulness at work, mindfulness at home. When you come home, do some chanting, maybe chant the Metta Sutta, chant the different chants that we do, which is both a practice of mindfulness and helps you to reflect on the teachings. And then practice meditation when you get the time in to improve the level of your mindfulness and contemplate your various moods. If you have stress arising, try to see, recognize, well, these moods are stressful, these are something that I should deal with and resolve. And use your mindfulness and then investigate them to try to see how they're impermanent and they're not self, how they're conditions of mind that can be let go of. The alternative is, if we don't do this, then obviously our stress might just continue and even intensify, get worse over time if we're doing nothing about it. And of course our state of mind will decline, we'll have more unhappiness. So we must try to keep practicing. That's a similar question. These days I and with lots of stress at work after the recent appointment of a new team leader to our section. On top of the work, he starts tearing about the Lord Buddha, and once he mentioned that he is more superior than the Lord Buddha. Then I said to him, you might be superior, but I am expecting the noble qualities of the Buddha. Oh, I respect the noble qualities of the Buddha. The team leader and also another officer always tell things to Buddha. Now I am trying to listen and not tell anything, not say anything. Maybe they want to annoy me. Please advise me how to face this type of atmosphere. Yes, of course, when you live or work with people with wrong views, michaditi, then it's going to be difficult and a testing time. As we've been discussing, one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. One who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. So try to see this situation and what's arising as Dhamma. You could see that everything in the end is impermanent, it's uncertain. Those people are uncertain, what they say is uncertain, their views and opinions are uncertain. It's nothing really real or substantial. What is uncertain, impermanent, is also not self. Their words are not self. They are ultimately, they are the four elements, the five khandhas. They're not self as well. This is a way of reflecting on the experience so that one doesn't take it too personally and get too upset and stressed by the whole thing. One learns to reflect on what's going on and see it as anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is what we mean by seeing things as Dhamma. And it allows us to let go of our normal attachment, this sense of self that comes up and makes us react to what people say and do around us. We're just seeing it as Dhamma arising and passing away, rather than believing everything, attaching to it and getting caught into suffering. Keep bringing up mindfulness then, establishing mindfulness of the Dhamma, and also develop a lot of metta, goodwill, patience to deal with the situation. Try not to give in to anger or argue with them. Don't get into discussions that you're just going to end up arguing about the Buddha or the teachings of the Buddha. It's not worth it, it's not helpful. Try just to be patient with the situation. But obviously if it's really hopeless and it actually affects the work that you do, then you could even consider looking for work elsewhere if it's that bad. Otherwise, just try to be patient with it. But we have to accept in this world there are many kinds of people. It's normal. There are different people with different views and opinions, different beliefs. You'll never escape that in the world. It's full of many types, many characters. So try to just see that. That is the normal way of human beings. And to not attach, not to think too much about it and just see, well, this is just the way it is. Is there a way to communicate with one who has passed away through meditation? Normally speaking, when somebody dies, there's no way that we can communicate with them anymore. Wherever their consciousness is gone, it's gone. We can't see them, we can't talk to them. Having said that, if that being has been reborn in a lower realm, ghost realm, animal realm, hell realm, then pretty much there's nothing much you can do. If a being is close to being reborn as a human being, what we call a sambhavesi, then maybe there's a chance somebody with skill in meditation may be able to connect with them, contact them, communicate with them. If a being is reborn in a heaven realm, again, very difficult to communicate with them, but sometimes if they are recently reborn in a heaven realm, maybe somebody with samadhi and special psychic powers may be able to communicate with them. But again, over time, born into that realm, then the connection with the previous birth is lost, so it's very difficult to communicate. And in these other realms that we can't see, the sense of time is totally different from the human realm. They say in the lower heaven realm, the Jatu Maharajika, one day is equal to 50 years in a human realm. Or in the next realm up, 100 years, one day is equal to 100 years in a human realm. So obviously the whole sense of time and the perception of time is different, so this makes communication difficult. How to protect myself from anger? How to make the mind forgive and forget? How to reduce my desperation? When we fall into anger, it's always with a sense of self, self-view arising that we cling on to. Maybe if you have that habit, make a resolution that you're not going to give in to anger, just for one day. Today I'm not going to give in to anger. Whatever situations arise, whoever I meet and so on, I'm not going to give in to anger. That might be a good starting point. You make that firm resolution and then try and stick to it and use it as a guideline in these different situations. Contemplate the impermanence of life, the uncertainty of it. You don't know, this might be the last day of your life. If you are one who's tempted to, you know, always get angry and annoyed with different things or people, just think, well, that means maybe if today is the last day of my life, I'll die with this angry state of mind. Maybe it'll mean I'll be reborn in some very unpleasant place as a karmic result. Do I want to die just angry and miserable like that? So really use that reflection on impermanence to help yourself see the need and get up the motivation to really avoid falling into states of anger and building up a lot of anger in your mind. And obviously practice frequently, practice regularly, bringing up mindfulness and then metta, the meditation on developing goodwill, compassion, and from that we get a sense of forgiveness and letting go. Of course, at first it's difficult. This practice takes time because we're changing a part of our character, personality, and the thoughts of anger will keep coming up. But if you keep practicing and keep establishing mindfulness, recognizing them, then you can little by little let go of them and change that. Maybe you had previously a very fixed view about somebody or something that just always made you angry every time that thing came up or you met that person, that fixed view always made you angry. So see how you can loosen that fixed view. Maybe look at things from their side. If it's a person you're angry with, you know, what is their side of things? How do they view things? Try and develop some empathy or understanding, look at things from different angles. And you'll find if you do that, well, little by little, the sense of stress and unhappiness in your own heart will actually start to get less, fade away. So basically keep practicing letting go of these different negative moods. Just see them as impermanent and not self over and over again, and gradually you'll free your mind from anger. Tanajan, thank you very much for your presence and your priceless generosity. My question is, with today's technology, is it possible to create a person with good qualities from the DNA found in relics? It says it's a very good idea. Don't think anybody's thought of it yet. Maybe we should go away and ask the scientists to work on this as a project. Get some DNA from relics, try and create somebody who's very special, very pure and wise, peaceful. You know, it's a good idea, but in practice it's difficult because in birth involves not just the material side of things, it also involves consciousness, which you can't just extract that from a relic, which is a material thing. Consciousness obviously is conditioned by karma. Good and bad karma, and that's what birth is. You have an embryo and consciousness joins that embryo according to its karma, and then a human being is born and lives. So it still comes back to training consciousness and, you know, training our own consciousness to be good and pure and mature and progress in our spiritual practice. Nevertheless, it's a good idea, he thinks. See if we can do it. Aside from the issue of whether you could make somebody very good arise out of the DNA from a relic, he says, well, just science at the moment, we can't make even a bad person arise from DNA. We can't make any person yet. We haven't got that far with technology, with getting DNA. You know, it's the stuff of movies and science fiction at the moment. So we'll just have to wait.
Do
to respectfully ask Kanajan, please explain when we should and shouldn't contemplate Dhamma. Previously, I would try to contemplate Dhamma as different situations, such as food being the four elements. Now, different situations occurred, such as food being the four elements. But now I'm hearing that we should only contemplate if the mind is peaceful, otherwise it is just thinking. Please would Tenajan clarify what we should do, because my mind is very active and usually not peaceful. So we can use the method of meditating using thought as a cause for peaceful states to arise and to bring up mindfulness. We can direct our thoughts to the Dhamma in different situations, such as you've described, say, eating food. We start thinking about what we're doing and why and the meaning of it using the Dhamma. So we reflect, oh, this food is four elements which go in to nourish the body and so on. We can do that method. That's quite okay. And this is what we call wisdom developing samadhi. The aim is to help bring up mindfulness and then to let go of all the other distracted, discursive states of mind, thinking about many different things. Just directing the mind to think of what you're doing right now, so maybe eating food, for instance. And by doing this, directing the mind, putting its attention on the Dhamma of that experience at that time, one can give rise to states of calm. The mind becomes more peaceful, mindfulness arises, and more wisdom arises. But of course, there'll be times when that doesn't work. You won't always be able to just direct the mind and its thoughts to the Dhamma in one particular situation. Sometimes the mind is all over the place. It's very confused or agitated. So we may have to use our meditation object then, just one single object like the breath or the mantra buddho, to really cut through all the discursive and distracted thinking. Other times you want to recite buddho, 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 or be with the in-breath, the out-breath. Whatever you do, the mind won't stay with that object. It's too subtle and it's not settled enough. So then you might have to go back to actually using thought skillfully to develop some understanding of what's going on. Direct your mind to think about Dhamma at that time. Because the mind is not settled, you use that unsettled energy but direct it to think of the Dhamma, and that can bring the mind back to a state of peace. So really it's not one way or the other. You can alternate as you practice sometimes, seeing what is appropriate for the situation. And sometimes thinking about the Dhamma, that can lead on to peaceful states of mind. Other times you just drop all your thinking and you focus on your object, and that's necessary as well. And then you can alternate between the two styles. There's still many unanswered questions, unfortunately, but we've reached the end of our time because many people have to head home. So we'll leave it there. I'm sure everybody is very grateful for Tenajan's presence and sharing his experience in the practice with us over these last few days. We've also been living together in the monastery for a few days, so it's our custom before leaving the monastery, leaving the retreat, that we have one last ceremony asking forgiveness from Tenajan and the Sangha and each other in the formal way. And this you'll find in the back of the chanting book.